court proceed to the third case, Packovich versus Broadspire Services. Mr. Barron.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. Lisa Packovich was receiving long-term disability benefits pursuant to an ERISA policy from the plan administrator, Broadspire. By letter dated June 22, 2004, the plan informed Lisa that it had considered her appeal and that the long-term disability benefits that she had been receiving were being terminated. And it told her, you've exhausted all your administrative remedies, sue us. She accepted their invitation. We filed suit in front of the district court, and the district court agreed with us. The district court said that the one and only reason that Broadspire gave for denying her disability benefits was downright unreasonable. And I thought, except that the opinion was longer than that, I knew I was going to get something I didn't like when I read further, it should be over. But it wasn't, because the district court then accepted Broadspire's invitation to find a different reason, a reason that was not articulated in any notice that had been given to Lisa Packovich. The district, in front of the district court, in its motion for summary judgment, Broadspire suggested, well, if you don't agree with us for the reason we gave her, here's another one. And for the first time in the middle of litigation, they come up with a new reason. They say, well, okay, we cut off benefits as of May 15th, but best case scenario, all she was ever going to do was get benefits through July 15th, because then the any occupation definition kicks in.
But didn't your pleading ask that she be paid all benefits to which she was entitled under the plan?
All, yes, it is. Yes, we did. And the way we did
that would be beyond the 20. This only becomes important after the 24-month period when I guess you have to be in worse shape then. You can't do anything.
Well, actually, that's what you would think, that you can't do anything. But of course, that's not it. The policy actually has. And let me back up a little bit. First of all, it's only one policy. It's not as if it's two policies. It's not as if there's a ONOC and then an any occupation policy. There's one long-term disability policy. They gave one reason for terminating, and we knew, and when it came into the office, I looked at it and said, this is bogus. This isn't going to hold up. That's the reason. And once we established that the only reason that they gave doesn't hold up, then the status quo kicks back in. And yes, the answer to your question is yes, we ask for all benefits, because they only articulated one reason for terminating benefits, and therefore she's entitled to benefits.
So doesn't that reason imply, though, that she would be able to resume any occupation if she could resume her own?
Well, but not necessarily, because there's a different analysis. Any occupation, and we use that as a shorthand, and I guess it's careful that we don't use that shorthand. We all, in our business, use shorthands all the time. But it actually says any occupation you could be expected to engage in, consideration given to your education, training, and experience. And those mean something. There has to be an analysis. And they have to give notice to somebody like Lisa Packovich to say, based on your education, training, and experience, we think you can do something. And we've cited to the court case law where they have to do a vocational analysis. It has to mean something. In fact, there is an Illinois statute that says any occupation can't mean any occupation whatsoever. It doesn't mean that if Lisa Packovich can sit on the corner and sell pencils, she doesn't get disability.
So the plan would have to send two notices. Prior to 24 months, they'd have to send a notice that she could resume her own occupation, and then at the expiration of 24 months would have to send a notice saying, and you can now resume any occupation.
Not necessarily. I mean, they take a little bit of a gamble. If it's so clear to them that she can do her own occupation, and if they're right, they don't have to send the next. But if they want to be sure, and they're the ones, and particularly it's pretty egregious in this situation because they sent it at the 22nd month of 24. She actually gets the notice in the middle of June, saying that she's terminated as of July 15th. It certainly wouldn't have been difficult for them to engage in that. And in fact, by a letter of early 2004, they told her they were initiating that process. The fact is, when you look through it, they never did. They never initiated exactly. They never did what they said they were going to do, which was to initiate the process of looking at any occupation. So they can make a business decision. They can put all their eggs in one basket and say, we're sure this is going to hold up. But if they have any doubt, then yeah, then the prudent, and nobody knows more about doing this stuff than the plan administrators, that's their business. The prudent, if they want to be really safe, is then initiate the second step. And it's fair to Lisa Pakovich to say, claimant, Ms. Pakovich, we're turning you down because we think you can do your occupation, but we're also turning you down because, and we've engaged in this analysis, and if you disagree with us, we're going to turn you down because you can do any occupation. And if you disagree with us, provide us with additional information. Now, in this case, it's especially egregious because there was one determination of any occupation. The Social Security Administration did that determination. And the Social Security Administration determined that she couldn't engage in any gainful employment. And they benefited from that. As soon as they learned about the fact that she could engage, that she had won her Social Security Administration, they sent her a bill for $14,000 to this disabled person. Give us $14,000 because you've been determined to be totally disabled by Social Security Administration. And she paid it. And then they turned around and they said, we're going to now analyze this on our own, but they didn't. It was easy for them to do what they said they were going to do and do both determinations if they want to get the protection of both determinations. Perhaps, and the final point I have is what's the appropriate remedy? And I think that might be the more difficult problem in this case, actually. Do we send it back to the district court and then to the plan administrator and say, okay, do over. Determine what her level of function was as of July 2004. And if I give this court lots of credit for moving quickly, say in June of 2008, tell us what her determination was almost 4 years ago. Her condition was 4 years ago. It's almost an impossible position that she would be in, and it's one they created. I think the appropriate remedy is simply to reinstate the status quo. She was receiving disability benefits. And this goes back to the very first question, Judge Evans. What did we ask for? We asked to restate the status quo. Put us back where we were. She was receiving benefits. And then they still, under the contract, they have the right to send her today, tomorrow, a year from now, any reasonable amount of time to have her be evaluated. The appropriate remedy, reinstate benefits. Otherwise, somebody has nothing but a dispute.
As to the first set of circumstances where we would, under the possible scenario of remanding for determination in 04 rather than 08, as you suggest, would be more appropriate. But explain again why the 04 analysis couldn't be undertaken. Is that because there's no medical records available? I mean, why?
Well, no, she wasn't even on notice that was a reason for determination. She had already gotten her Social Security determination. Then she was denied as of May. Nobody said, by the way, in June or July of 04, let's get a functional capacity exam. Well, actually, that's not quite right. One of their doctors said we need another FCE, but nobody did it. There was no FCE done. And then we have the burden of proof, and we're going to come forward, and they're going to say, well, you guys don't have any evidence of what our condition was in 04. Well, you didn't ask us to do it. But we're going to turn.
You're saying that it's a near impossibility to create the analysis for an 04 assessment?
Well, I don't know because it hasn't been done. I worry that I'm going to be back in front of you all again saying, fighting this issue again, saying the determination they made in the summer of 08 about what her condition was in 04 was downright unreasonable. They're the one that put us in here, and I don't think you should have to keep spending your judicial resources because they decided that they were going to gamble on only doing the cheapest evaluation they could, and the one evaluation they did was downright unreasonable. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Barron. Mr. Penrose?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My colleague suggests a completely unworkable rule in this circumstance. If we tease out the scenario, but we change one fact, assume the own occupation denial was done in not the 22nd month, but let's say the third month. If this Court rules as my colleague suggested, then that means that any denial of own occupation triggers, and I use that term for a reason, because it will trigger any occupation disability 10, 15, 20 months later. I don't think ERISA requires that, and it certainly doesn't require that in the statute, or the statute at issue, Section 503, talks about giving the reasons for a claim that is denied. I think everyone here agrees that we never denied any occupation because we never got to that period in the analysis. 2 months was a close, absolutely. But viewing it from a fiduciary standpoint, if we had said, oh, by the way, we're going to deny you on any occupation, then all of a sudden we have breach of fiduciary duty claims. And how can you do that? You're not even following the plan. The plan says after 24 months, you must be unable to perform any occupation. And I use that as a shorthand. So that's the first problem we have. To rule, as my colleague suggests, is going to create a rule that does not exist in ERISA, for one thing, and number two, will create havoc on plans to do these things under pain of if you don't do it, then you are, forever.
No, I think you could have waited until the 24th month and then said, the plan could have then said, you can now do, you're not foreclosed from doing any occupation, and we'll.
Maybe, Your Honor.
We'll have a determination made of that.
And why I say maybe.
Or you could have in the 22nd month said you can't, you are now able to do your occupation or any other occupation, and then it would have all been presented properly to a plan administrator for a decision.
Maybe. And the reason why I say maybe, Your Honor, is because the regulations, the new regulations, which we would have been under on this claim, the review period is 45 days. And if we don't do it within 45 days, then we're back here saying, oh, we didn't have a decision, and then we're subject to the de novo review. And to be quite honest, I was actually the attorney at the trial court, and that's what I assumed where I would end up all along, because it was so close, as Your Honor suggested. I assumed that the argument would be, oh, by the way, you should have given us any occupation denial, and you didn't. Therefore, it is deemed denied under the new regulations, and I get a de novo review, which admittedly the judge in the district court did not specifically use that phraseology. But since we didn't decide anything and the court did, it was a de novo review. I don't think we can really say otherwise because there was nothing to give deference to. So if you take a step back from where we were, and as Your Honor asked my colleague, he asked for all benefits, or the plaintiff asked for all benefits. There were two options here. The district court could have said, you know what, there's just not enough here to analyze any occupation. I'm going to send that back. Or, which is what the district court did, the district court said, there is a sufficient record, and I'm going to review that because, A, the plaintiff said so, and, B, because I believe there's enough evidence. And the district court made that determination, giving no deference to us because there was nothing to give deference to.
So even though the plan had not denied any occupation, the judge did?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And the judge reviewed the record at the insistence of the plaintiff. Now, there could have been another option here, which we would have opposed, but the other option would be under Seventh Circuit precedent. There is a small chance that the plaintiff could have said, Your Honor, sending it back to the administrator, that's a colossal waste of time. They already think I can do my job, so what are they going to say if I ask them to review any jobs? They're going to say the exact same thing. It's going to be futile, which is this court and most circuits courts have said, you don't need exhaustion. So if that would have been the scenario, the judge could have done two things. They could have reviewed the record, which they did, or they could have said, if, you know what, if this record is so undeveloped, I'm going to allow the plaintiff to bring in additional evidence. That was never asked for, and that would have been a plaintiff's dream, I guess, in ERISA land, that you get new evidence that, that the district court had never even viewed. In fact, the plaintiff here got the second best thing. She got a review without deference, and the judge was pretty clear that our plan language is proper under Hertzberger. I don't think that that would be a serious challenge. So if the judge had remanded the case back, we'd be even in a better position. As it is, now what do we do? And that's, I suppose, a fair question.
Isn't that what would have been the preferred approach to send it to the plan administrator?
Preferred? From our perspective, absolutely, because then we could compile a record. I don't believe vocational analysis was really required, but if we had done that, that would even be more evidence, and we would have gotten an arbitrary and capricious standard. So the plaintiff would actually be in a worse position. And to be perfectly honest, being the trial counsel, I considered that. In fact, I admittedly weakly suggested it in terms of my response to the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment. But I did not present it as an affirmative defense for two reasons. Number one, I thought we would win on the review of the ONOC. And two, if we didn't, the record was overwhelming with evidence that she could perform sedentary work. And as the district court judge stated, she had done the prior sedentary-type work. On the initial questionnaire, when she lists all her jobs, there were three or four of them indicating a kind of a computer-type job. And the Seventh Circuit is clear that you don't have to do a full-blown vocational analysis in every single situation. Certainly not a rule that requires that. I think from a procedural standpoint, I think the court's job is even easier. We don't even have to get this far because the main reason my colleague suggests that all this should occur was because we did not give a denial of any occupational disability, but that doesn't appear in the brief and summary judgment. In fact, the judge in the district court was pretty clear that that claim, as it were, that argument was not developed, and that's why the Rule 59 motion was denied. And if it's not developed or suggested at the district court level, it doesn't even need to be considered at this level. But even if it does, even if you assume everything, the worst possible case scenario, courts are pretty clear that when a plan doesn't timely give notice or gives no notice, the proper standard is de novo review. And if the record is terrible, you can either send it back or allow outside evidence to come in. My colleague suggests that the status quo should be maintained. Well, the only status quo was any occupation disability. The plan has never decided any occupation. In those cases, the Halperin case and the Schneider case, those were both cases where they were going along just fine and the plan cut off benefits to which you were otherwise entitled to. And otherwise, there had been an initial decision that, yes, you are disabled from any occupation. Then 2-3 years down the road, they change their minds. They think the condition gets better. That's a different situation. We don't have that here at all because the plan has never said you can do no occupation. If that was the case, I think that would be a different situation. So at the end of the day, from a procedural standpoint, the court can just say it was not properly presented. But even if it was presented, the plaintiff got the best possible decision that she could have possibly gotten. She got de novo review on a record where she made a motion under Rule 52 on the administrative record stating, I want all my benefits. And when you ask for something like that and you don't like the answer, you can't turn around and change your mind on appeal and say, well, I know I asked for that, but you know what? I'm changing my mind now. They never decided something before it was due, and now I forevermore get benefits. And if the court doesn't have any questions, I'll relinquish the rest of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Penrose.
You're welcome.
Mr. Barron?
I think it's critical that we start by looking at the district court's opinion. It simply was not de novo review. If the court looks at the page 20 of the district court's opinion, The district court wrote, for the reasons stated above, the court denies plaintiff's motion to strike, grants in part, and denies in part defendant's motion for summary judgment. The district court ruled on a summary judgment on the Broadspire's motion for summary judgment. That's not...
But I don't understand why you're not better off with that procedure, with the judge looking at it, rather than having a remand to a plan administrator who probably here is predisposed to deny the relief, and then you have to come back, and then you're subject to a higher standard of review.
ERISA gives us... Well, first of all, we didn't get that. We got the worst of both worlds. We got a district court judge who thought he was bound by an arbitrary and capricious standard on an incomplete record. We didn't get a chance. Lisa wasn't notified and didn't get an opportunity to develop the record as regards what she was able to do. And in fact, if we had been told you can do any OC, then we would have argued it that way. And so it's really just exactly the opposite. We got the worst of all worlds. The problem we're in was what problem created at page 19 of defendant's memorandum. Defendant's the one that asked, under the terms, told the district court, you can do this. Under the terms of the plan, after 2 years of benefits to continue to receive benefit, plaintiff must be disabled from all occupations. We didn't put that ball into play. Broadspire put that ball into play. And the reason we're at this awkward procedural spot is because the district court accepted an invitation that probably should have never been made to the district court. Perhaps the best thing that should have happened was for the district court to send it back and for us to develop a full record. But for Lisa Pakovich to lose any occupation benefits going into the future on an incomplete record that she never got received notice of and never was allowed to participate in violates all the principles of ERISA.
But your relief was to be granted all benefits, not to have a remand to have the plan administrator consider the all occupation limitation.
And then once benefits are reinstated, they have the right to send her for an evaluation. It's not like we get benefits reinstated and then now from now until the rest of her life she gets benefits. They get to evaluate her. So all that happens is it actually does get remanded, but she gets the benefits until such time as they make a proper determination.
Just before you sit down, what's the dollar amount here? I mean, these Social Security disability benefits are a set-off against anything she's entitled to under the plan. And what's the difference?
As I was flying up from St. Louis this morning, I was thinking, what questions am I going to get asked? And I, just as the plane is slamming down the runway, somebody's got to ask me that question. It's not a lot. I think it's $700. It's $700 a month. I think it's not a huge amount. It got deducted by the amount of Social Security Administration. I can tell you, it's not huge.
New York Times ran a big front page article 2-3 weeks ago about it, these plans pushing people to get disability benefits under Social Security because that's a great benefit to the plan, and how it's clogging up the Social Security Administrative Law judges and appeals counsel.
Judge Posner's opinion in Ladd is interesting. His concurring opinion there, where he talks about a sort of quasi race judicata. There might be a lot of wisdom to that. Thank you.
He wrote the majority opinion in Ladd.
Well, that's right. It was sort of dicta thrown on at the end.
He has a little dicta occasionally sneaks in there.
No comment.
Thank you, Mr. Barrett. Thank you, Mr. Penrose. The case is taken under advisement.